50,000 years ago, give or take, it was us against them, and they were the home team. The winners would eat, the losers would fade into history. This food fight for the ages leads us to ask, how did dogs save humanity?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned in to the 1022nd edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Luganville who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Struby on the boards. Hello, Jason.
Hey, good morning, Michael.
Folks, it was indeed the food fight for the ages when we humans invaded the home territory of the Neanderthal some 50,000 years ago, give or take. The winner would eat, the loser would fade into fossil. Obviously, we won, and the Neanderthal lost. But how did we win, and they lose? Today we have a means to look back 50,000 years or so and see things with a remarkable degree of clarity. We can look at the fossilized bones and see from which species the bones came and for what purposes the bones were used. We can date materials made of carbon and thus establish an accurate timeline for when life was lived. And we can sequence genes and know what ate what. Given these remarkable skills, we can look back and see ourselves involved in a fight for survival against the Neanderthal who were, like very distant relatives, of the same genus, but of a different species. And so today we look back and ask, how did we humans win the fight for the ages? And who better to ask than an anthropology professor who wrote the book, The Invaders, and that would be Pat Shipman. Pat, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Pleasure to have you aboard. So you, first of all, you wrote The Invaders, and The Invaders is about?
It's about really two themes that are intertwined. One is the basic notion that we have to consider ourselves, that is, anatomically modern human beings, to be an invasive species.
And very good at it, right?
And very, very good at it. Probably the most invasive species and the most successful invasive species that has ever lived.
And the other thing?
The other thing is that at about the time that we were competing very seriously with Neanderthals in ancient Europe, we domesticated or began to domesticate dogs. And that gave us a phenomenal advantage and a very powerful way to exploit the habitat that we were sharing with our near cousins.
Well, Pat, as an anthropology professor, you and your peers have developed remarkable ways of looking back in times. You yourself are a specialist. You're a taphonomist, right?
Yes.
What the heck is that?
Nobody knows what that means. Basically, the primary question I try to ask when I look at a group of fossils, yes, they're a picture of the past, but how did they come to be in this place? What is the story that each of those fossils tells us about who was there, who was eating what, who was using what, how long did they live? How successful were they? So it's a kind of a, how do we get here?
So it's kind of like a puzzle piece. You pick up a bone or a fossil of a bone and you put it on the table in front of you and you say, what is the story behind this bone?
That's it exactly, yes.
Wow. You folks have developed some remarkable tools to actually look back in time 50,000 years more. And let's talk a little bit about those tools so the folks out there listening will know just how you can make these assertions that you're making. First of all, you are a bone person, right? You look at how bones become fossils and the story behind them. What do you look at when you look at a bone?
Okay, so the first question would be, what animal is this bone from? And what happened to it between the time it was part of that animal and now? We are often looking for things like types of damage on the bone that might tell us if it was cut with stone tools, if it was burned, if it was chewed by some kind of ancient predator. So we're looking for the life history of that particular fossil. And as you do this for a whole assemblage from a single site, you begin to get a pretty nuanced picture of what happened and how that site formed and what kind of story it tells you.
Mm-hmm. And so you get to be pretty good at looking at the nicks and knacks on bones and saying, well, this was a situation in which a stone tool was used to deflesh the bone or something, or skin the hide or what have you. You can actually tell that?
Oh, yes. It's not hard at all. We did a lot of experimental work, literally doing things like that ourselves. And, of course, this isn't only me. I'm not the only person who's ever done this. And also looking at situations in the world where we can trace what has happened to a bone, we can find a carnivore lair, we can see what carnivore it is, we can collect the bones from the carnivore's lair and see what it's chewed and how it's chewed them and the kind of marks it's left with its teeth, and determine and prove whether or not they are the same or different from what you leave with stone tools, or for that matter, metal tools,
right.
Although that isn't an issue in this question.
A lot of information gathering there, I sense.
Yes, years.
huge body of information that's been gathered over time by anthropologists looking at these things. Another tool you have is carbon dating. What exactly does that do?
Carbon dating is an absolutely vital tool in all of this. You can't build a story, a scenario, a hypothesis, a theory, if you don't know the sequence in which things happened. What carbon 14 dating does is it takes the fossil, the tooth, in some cases charcoal, in some cases snail shells and things like that, but it takes whatever object you had that was once alive and thus incorporating carbon into its own tissues, and it tells you how long it's been since that animal, human, whatever, was alive. Now, recently, there have been huge breakthroughs in decontaminating samples for radiocarbon dating. The problem is, if I pick up a bone with my bare hands, or eat lunch in the lab, or dig it up out of the ground, I'm getting some of my carbon and some of the carbon from my lunch and some of the carbon from the bird that just flew by and pooped on that specimen. Recently, a group primarily in Oxford University in England has made big breakthroughs in decontaminating specimens, so you remove the modern carbon. Now, how important this is, I'll give you a little example. I have, let us say here in front of me, a bone that is 50,000 years old. But if it is contaminated with only 1% of modern carbon, and you think 1%, how much difference could that make? Then when you date that bone, it will say it's 37,000 years old, not 50,000 years old. So it's an enormous source of error.
So the recent advances in carbon dating have really opened your eyes as to the exact timeline or sequence of when events happened.
Yes, and one of the things that seems to tell us with the best data we have right now is that there are no Neanderthals at all, after about 40,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
So if Neanderthals come in, maybe if modern humans come into Neanderthal territory, maybe the earliest invaders at 50, but, you know, little trickle. This isn't a march.
Right.
This is a few people here, a few people there. Some of them die, some of them survive. You get to maybe 45, 46, maybe even 42,000 years ago, when they really are meeting up with Neanderthals.
Sure.
They are over a lot of Europe and into parts of Asia.
And then,
and the competition is setting in.
Yeah, and then the final tool that we want to discuss when we get back from this quick break is the ability to sequence genes. And from that ability to be able to actually see what those people and their critters actually were eating. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Pat Shipman, the author of The Invaders and You. You're invited to participate today if you have some good questions and comments about the Neanderthal and us. 831-479-1080. 831-479-1080. Right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Well, folks, 50,000 years ago, it was us against the Neanderthal, and we won. But how did we win? Well, that's what we're trying to ask today with Looking Back 50,000 Years with Pat Shipman, the author of The Invaders. And we have tools, among them the ability to sequence genes. What does that ability allow us to see, Pat?
It allows us to see a couple of things. One, which has been much talked about, is that there was a little bit, an infrequent amount of crossbreeding between Neanderthals and modern humans.
Now, I know some of those folks, by the way.
Many of us think that.
Yeah.
Before you get too excited about that answer, it's been calculated that as few as 75 successful matings, that means producing an offspring that lived, would account for what we see.
Wow.
In terms of genetics. So it's not very common. And if you think about the fear and trepidation with which we approach people who look very different from us,
mm-hmm.
talk differently, act differently, wear different clothes, behave differently, and you think about all the, oh, my God, what, you know, who is that person and what are they doing? Even if you recognize they're similar, you get scared. You're not
sure.
necessarily romantically inclined. The differences would have been greater than that.
Yeah, we want to pick up the differences just a minute, but I want to finish that gene sequencing. Because not only does it ability to look into the genes tell us whether there was cross mating, but it also actually allows us to see what people and animals were eating, right?
Well, that's not the genes. That's the chemical composition of the bone.
Okay. Oh, okay. Okay. So that's another tool then.
That's another tool called isotopic analysis. And as you eat your cheeseburger for lunch, you're incorporating different elements into your flesh, into your bones, and they stay there. If you're eating a nut and fruit cake, you're putting different elements in your bones than if you're eating a steak or a cheeseburger,
mm-hmm.
more likely. So we can look at the proportions of different elements and the proportions of those elements in the animals around you and see which ones you were eating the most. And Neanderthals and modern humans were eating the same animals, although in somewhat different proportions.
Mm-hmm. So
what that means is, you know, that's all there is to eat. We've all got the same choices. The question is, who can do a better job of getting that food?
Well, Pat Chipman is a professor of anthropology and a taphonomist, a person who looks at the bones very closely and writes about these things. You've probably have considered the Homo sapien and the Neanderthal quite closely, and perhaps you'd be so kind as to give us a thumbnail sketch of these two critters, one of which is us.
Right. Well, I hope all your listeners know what humans look like, so I won't spend too much time on the humans. Neanderthals were not necessarily taller than us, but they were massively muscular and big-boned. They had big brains, in fact, slightly bigger brains than ours. They had big brow ridges on the front of their heads. But most of what you see is this tremendous build for strength and endurance. And compared to them, we look like a bunch of wimps. Even professional athletes today are wimpy compared to the way Neanderthals were built. So they were people who worked hard for their living, physically hard.
And both of these species, the Neanderthalensis and the sapiens, came out of Africa. Why does everybody come out of Africa?
Because that's where we all came from. That's where it all starts. With anything resembling a human or a human ancestor, you know, that's...
So that's where we came from. That's where lightning struck way back when, and all of a sudden there we were. So the Neanderthal came out of Africa millennia before we did, right?
Right, long before, probably a couple hundred thousand years before we did. And they developed into the form we know in Europe and a little bit of Asia. So they are really a European evolved form. The guys that were left behind in Africa were in the meantime evolving into modern humans.
Wow.
And the difference, you know, turns out to be very significant, but they had fire, we had fire. They had tools, we had tools. They were not stupid. They were not, you know, the alley-oop caveman of cartoons. They were pretty clever and did very, very well in their habitat as basically big game hunters, which is exactly what we were doing in a different habitat.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. Having been raised in Montana and having grown up a great fan of the Plains Indians, it doesn't seem like all that much difference.
You know? you're onto something there. What the Plains Indians had that Neanderthals didn't.
Horse.
Horse, dog.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good.
Now, horses don't come into the picture this early, but dogs do. Dogs are the first domesticated animal.
Now, let me go back once.
Dogs.
Okay, let me go back before we get to dogs. Let me go back one step. Do you see a huge, I mean, you probably really have considered, you know, Homo sapiens of this time. If you were to strip away all the accoutrements of our supposed civilization, you know, the cell phones and the remote controls and all this stuff, are we all that much different, do you think?
We are different from humans then in the sense that we have elaborated and continue to elaborate various kinds of tools, and I use that word really broadly, to make our lives easier.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the tool making and tool utilization, but wasn't that what was, where you're going to take us with respect to the Homo sapiens? Weren't they the real innovators here?
They were innovators in one big sense. Everybody had stone tools. Everybody had spears. So you've got sharp things, you've got heavy things, you've got things you can throw, you've got things you can cut with, like sort of mini razor blades. And that is a pretty efficient bunch of equipment, a pretty efficient set of equipment.
Mm-hmm.
What we did was we took this step that enlarges the idea of tools. That is, we collaborated with another animal, another powerful top predator, the wolf, and eventually, in a means that benefited both of us, we formed an unspoken agreement of working together and of changing their genetics so they were not so aggressive towards us, and they dropped some of the wolfy habits, and changing our genetics so we could communicate better with them.
Mm-hmm. And so if you can domesticate a wolf, you could probably domesticate wild cattle and horses and other critters too, right?
Much later, though.
Much later, of course. But the wolf was...
in time, but yes. And there are animals you simply cannot domesticate.
Mm-hmm.
One of the notorious ones is zebras. You know, we know about mules and donkeys and burros and horses and mini horses and ponies and all those things. It seemed to have worked many times with many different ancestors. Zebras will not do it.
Okay.
We're
going to have to take a quick break, Pat, but when we go back, I'd like to talk about the environment 50,000 years ago and how Neanderthal and Homo sapien coped with that environment and where that led us in the competition for food. Right back. A thousand years ago, there were no freeways, there were no grocery stores, there were no fast food joints. So how did we eat and what did we eat? Well, let's go back 50,000 years with Pat Shipman, the author of The Invaders. Pat, what on earth were people eating back then?
Lots of different things. Some of the prime targets, if you want to put it that way, for human or Neanderthal hunters were deer, wild cattle of various sorts, some of them even bigger than our bison today, wild horses. There were reindeer. There were, of course, a lot of plant foods. And the trouble is that we can only get the vaguest idea about what plant foods were left, because they don't preserve very well as fossils, except under extraordinary circumstances.
What about the chemical examination of bones that you were talking about?
Right.
Would that give us an idea of plant?
That gives us some idea of the kinds of plants that would be eaten, but you know, you can't be very specific. You can't even be.
Right. Mostly it was a meat eater's paradise, right?
It was a meat eater's paradise, and that clearly was a major issue, both for Neanderthals and for modern humans, because they were predatory.
So
they were the top of the food pyramid.
Yeah, so we have two apex predators, the Neanderthal and the humans, and then things started to change radically and drastically from 50,000 years down to 35, 40,000 years. All of a sudden, there was you call it a trophic cascade.
Yes. If you think of an ecosystem as a kind of pyramid with the common things down at the bottom, the plants and the very common plant eaters, and then the carnivores that feed on the plant eaters, and then the carnivores that may take other carnivores as well as plant eaters, you've got a pyramid. And what happens when you put a new predator at the top of the pyramid is there's a kind of ripple effect all the way down that changes the proportions and the lifestyle of everything else. Mm-hmm. So there's a single change, a single species often, and the whole story changes because
there's competition all of a sudden, and so there's a warfare going on for food. One other thing that you bring into the equation is climate change. You know, everybody's talking about climate change these days, and you suggest that there might have been climate change back then too.
There certainly was. We can't use that to account for the extinction of Neanderthals because they had already survived similar periods of climate change where it would go from cold and dry to much warmer and wetter and then back to cold and dry. So
we're talking over thousands of years, right?
Yes, we're talking about long periods of time. Mm-hmm. But sometimes the changes themselves occurred pretty rapidly. So there was a big swing of the climate so that the very far northern animals and plants would come much farther down in Europe. Mm-hmm. And that imposes different hunting issues. And, of course, the animals are following the plants as they move. And you know, the things I didn't mention when we were talking about animal foods is there were also things like woolly mammoths and woolly rhinos. Now, those are really hard to catch with handheld weapons.
Yeah, so we're going to pick that up in just a minute here. But first, I'd like to go back to the notion of invasive species and invasion biology. So first of all, we have the notion that we have climate change. So a lot of people point to the climate change and say it was the climate change that did away with the Neanderthals. But you're saying, nah, not so.
Well, they'd lived through it before.
Yeah.
So that one factor doesn't account for everything. You have to have something new, some new factor. And the new factor was us.
The invaders.
Yeah. And if you look at studies of places where there are new invaders now, new predatory invaders, the animals that get the worst of it are the indigenous animals, the native animals, that are the most like the one that's invading.
And you talk a lot about Yellowstone Park and the reintroduction of wolves into the Yellowstone ecosystem, which is about as close as anything I can imagine to invasion biology.
Yes, it's been a real boon to understanding what happens in an invasion like this because wolves had been in the Yellowstone area. They were part of that ecosystem. They were hunted out by people. They were not there for give or take 100, 125 years. And then they were reintroduced to establish the original ecosystem, to rebalance things. Now, there have been lots of studies of the animals in Yellowstone, and when it became clear that there was going to be a reintroduction of wolves, there was enough time for a lot of study of the animals that were there now, and then in the years since that reintroduction, which is now 20 years, 95, 105, 115, we've been able to see what differences have happened. So we really have a perfect experiment. We know what the before is. We reintroduce wolves. We can see what the after is.
So what happened to the coyotes and when they reintroduced wolves?
They got absolutely hammered. The overall number of coyotes went down. The number of coyotes in an area went down. They almost vanished from the areas that were the prime wolf habitats because the wolves were killing the coyotes and were killing their food. In the first 2 years after wolves were reintroduced, every killing of a coyote that was studied, observed, whatever, had to do with a wolf and a carcass that the wolf had killed. And the coyotes were trying to get some of it, and the wolves just took them out.
Wow. So the impact of you have two apex predators in an environment.
Right.
And you introduce you have one, and then you introduce another apex predator, and the impact is likely to be most profound on one of those two apex predators.
Right. And then you can follow the chain down in Yellowstone and say, okay, so what were the coyotes really preying on? They were preying on lots of pronghorn antelopes. Well, all of a sudden the pronghorn antelope numbers are going up, and they were preying on baby elk, and now the wolves are preying on grown-up elk. So the elk numbers come down. That means the areas that the elk used to graze flat suddenly have shrubs and vegetation and saplings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that is good for songbirds. And it changes the river courses. And all of a sudden, beavers are back in the rivers in Yellowstone because the vegetation along the rivers is different. The place the rivers are running has altered. Because there just aren't so damn many elk.
And you know, there's one photograph that you included in mm-hmm. The Invaders that really struck me, and it was the photograph of wolves surrounding a bison. And right. I'd like to pick that up and take us back 50,000 years and how humans used wolves in the hunting of woolly mammoths. Oh my goodness, the story's getting interesting. Do stay tuned. This is Food Chain, Michael Olson with Pat Shipman. Well, here's something to chew on for a little while, at any rate. Well, imagine the most profound adaption by in the history of the human race was the developing the ability for humans to make friends with wolves. How on that earth would that make a difference? Well, let's ask Pat Shipman, the author of The Invaders. How's that for a supposition, Pat?
Well, I think you could argue it. You were talking about one of the photos I have in my book where there is a bison surrounded by wolves.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a snowy day, so you can see the footprints. You can see there's a lot of churning. They've chased this bison there. They've moved it back and forth. They're charging it, running in, biting at it, harassing it, trying to tire it out. From a wolf's point of view, this is what wolves do. And even a bison, the biggest land animal we've got now,
is
fair game. You can do that.
It's held at bay. It can't do anything. It's been run to ground, and it's just standing there, and the wolves are circling it, looking for their opportunity to kill it and eat it.
That's right. But where the wolves get hurt is the one or the two that do run in and try to pull the animal down, you know, try to disable it to the point that it's on the ground, and then all the other wolves can come in. That's when they get hurt. That's when the bison gets its horns into the wolf and tosses it or stomps it or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But let's just suppose that those wolves doing that age-old wolf thing are partly domesticated, are familiar with, cooperative with humans who have distance weapons. They have spears and spear throwers, which propel a spear with much greater force over a much greater distance. Suppose they cooperate with the humans who can't take the animal out of the herd without getting killed, who can't run as fast as the wolves do, who can't sniff an animal out the way the wolves do, but they can come along after the animal is at bay and kill it or disable it from a distance. And what that means is both the wolves and the humans, or the not quite dogs, not quite wolves, to be fair, both of them get more food, they get it faster, they get it with less danger and less risk, and they benefit. The bison don't benefit, but they do. All you have to do is substitute a woolly mammoth for that bison, or a woolly rhino for that bison, and you've got the picture of what I think was going on.
And what actually was going on was the development of these mega mammoth sites in...
Yes.
Which were what?
These sites are absolutely... I mean, they are new when they turn up in the archaeological record, and they are staggering. I've been lucky enough to see some of them. And there may be 100 dead mammoths on a site. And this doesn't mean 100 pieces. This means 100 dead mammoths. That's a tremendous number, even if you allow that maybe they come back to the same place year after year because it's a good ambush site or something. Nothing like this has happened. Mammoths have been very rare in the archaeological record, in the record of animals killed and eaten by humans or Neanderthals before this. You might get one. You might get two. But all of a sudden, you've got 50. You've got 85. You've got 116. And there are a whole series of these sites, primarily in Central Europe, up towards, moving towards Siberia.
So it's kind of like it's like a CAFO. It's a confined animal operation almost, where they've been able to figure out how to kill so many woolly mammoths that they're starting to use the bones and hides for their shelters now.
Yeah, that's another phenomenal aspect. They're making huts out of mammoth bones. I mean, what a nutty thing to do, but you have to think of it as like a giant lumber yard, except the lumber is bone.
So
probably bone from the kill a year ago, so it's not quite so, you know, disgusting and fly-ridden and stinky.
Another interesting element of this alliance between wolf dogs and man and humans is that the humans were able to take down and kill a woolly mammoth and then not have to run and hide from other predators because they had the wolves to watch over them.
Yeah, this is also a big deal that it's a kind of a subtle point, but if there are a lot of other big, dangerous predators around, and you kill even a deer-sized animal, you know, maybe 100 pounds on a good day, you can't hang around that carcass. You either have to pick up the carcass, hack it to pieces, and run off someplace safer with it, or you have to hack off what you can and get out of there because the cave lions and the cave hyenas and the saber-toothed tigers are going to turn up, and they're going to give you trouble too. But all of a sudden, we start getting settlements, not long-term settlements. Don't think villages. Think campsites. Where all these mammoths are being killed. They get it. They kill it. It's cold, so, you know, it may freeze up, which is fine because that keeps it from rotting. And you can stay there and eat off it for weeks.
Now, all made possible by virtue of the fact that you have this alliance with the wolf dogs. But when we get back for the final break here, I have the big question, the big puzzle is, why were humans able to do this and Homo sapiens and Neanderthal not able to do this? This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson with Pat Shipman, author of The Invaders. We're talking about how we won the battle for food 50,000 years ago and got to live into the future, and whereas the Neanderthal lost and they went into fossils. Pat Shipman, The Invaders. Do stay tuned right back for the final question. Well, folks, 50,000 years ago, we fought it out with the Neanderthal for the food, and we won. And Pat Shipman, the author of The Invaders, and many others say it was our alliance with wolves that allowed us to win. So that we had this alliance with wolves, and of course, which extends through today with our dogs and whatnot, and cattle and horses and everything else, we look back to the Neanderthal and say, well, what was wrong with you? Why didn't you develop that alliance with wolves? So why didn't the Neanderthal develop this alliance, Pat?
Gee, I wish I knew. I can give you some ideas.
Okay.
And one of them is this. Humans are very, very unusual among the whole zoological family of primates in having whites to their eyes. That is, you know, the white of your eye around the colored iris. Other primates do not have this. It is possible that that developed only in the human line and not in the Neanderthal line. The reason that would matter is because having whites to your eyes lets you communicate with another human or another animal, where you're going or what you're doing, because they can see where you're looking. Now, yes, you can wave your arms and yell and say, I'm going to go around the bush that way, you go around the bush this way, and we'll trap him in between, but that kind of blows the plan. You can do it with your eyes, and dogs do watch people's eyes much more than wolves do. So it may be that we were much better communicators simply because of the structure of our eyeballs.
But that would be something. It would be hard to prove, right?
Well, it's going to be hard to prove until one of those clever geneticists figures out which gene makes this happen. And then it's going to be dead easy.
Ah, because then you can sequence the genes and know if the genes were there.
Yeah, but that hasn't happened yet. I keep making hints in public
and
hoping the right geneticist is going to hear this and say, oh, I can do that.
That would be easy.
Figure out how that works.
What a great puzzle that would solve then, right?
Yeah. Another possibility, and if you said you grew up in Montana, so you grew up around people who had livestock and had animals, and you will have observed that some people are a whole lot better at, we call it reading, what's going on with other animals.
Yeah.
And some people just don't get it. Mm-hmm. They don't understand that that cow is pissed off, or that that dog is about ready to bite the baby's head off, or, you know, that the horse is cranky. Some people just don't get it. And there's something intellectual and emotional about that ability to understand, to put yourself in another's place. And
Neanderthals just might not have been there.
They,
you know,
might,
Pat, in reading this wonderful book, something struck me, and that was a verse I read in the good book, Genesis, that said, And God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. And it seems like that's what happened.
Well, it did and didn't, because I would stress that this is a two-way street.
That's all we got time for. We're out of time. Pat Shipman, The Invaders, thank you.
Thank you. This has been great fun.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.